Look at me. Look at me, teacher. Look.
You think I'm crazy? Huh? Is that what he told you? Well, listen up!
Sleep well in your beds, because if this thing comes true, there ain't gonna be any more.
It's an elevator. Somebody sent those deads up here to get us. Now, there's no controls inside, but there's maintenance overrides in there.
I was wrong. We were so wrong. We must leave.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts from the US of A in the state of New Hampshire, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I am aggravated with equipment issues, but other than that, I am well.
Of course. And it's always that way, isn't it? Now, yes. In the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
Meh. I'm here. Let's get this over with.
Well, that's not positive. All right. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, how are you, sir?
A little tired and a little myth that vacation's almost over already. It went by way too fucking fast. I'm not in the mood for back. I'm not in the mood for the grind again.
Vacation? What's that?
It went by too quick. It's already almost Friday.
First off, this is March 19th, the day before the first day of spring 2015, and also the equinox, which, by the way, is a book by M.J. Preston. The Equinox, you can find it on Amazon.com.
And, that was a nice segue there, Phil.
Thank you. Thank you. And Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan, by the way, don't you?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askanity Podcast. That's Askanity. You can find it on let me try that one again. You can find it on the iTunes store or at Askanity.com. And speaking of MJ Preston, we are actually going to have him on the show this weekend. So next Sunday on episode 193, we will have an interview with Mr. Preston on our show.
Yep, he's doing a round to a couple other podcasts as well, as he mentioned to me today offline. And so it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say. I guess he's mostly trying to pimp his new book, Arcadia Event, which also can be found on Amazon.com.
Yeah, that's where I got my copy.
It'll be interesting to see how much Dan lets that happen.
How do you mean?
I mean, Dan really likes to talk to him about ice road trucking.
Oh, yes, very good. Yeah, so he'll be off topic. Yes,
but so you're on the road, right? And it's icy.
But then again, the new book...
What next?
The new book actually... takes place with ice truck drivers, so in
that's
theory,
that's true. So it will be more on topic this time than it was when we were trying to talk about the equinox.
Right. Now, Mike, you do a blog, a genre blog?
Yes, it's www.unnaturalselections.com. And the last thing I wrote was just my review in the for last year, and I'm trying to find something to write about now. Trying to find some time to write right now, and this is always my crappy time of year, and. It's hopefully going to be over on Saturday.
And, Abe, you do a genre book?
Yep, it's called the Reeler Movie Reviewer. Reeler spells R-E-E-L-E-R Movie Reviewer. You can find some posts on the Facebook page if you just Google it, or you can find on the right side of the main page of the Dark Discussions podcast.
Yep, that's right. And also on the main page of the Dark Discussions podcast, www.darkdiscussions.com, are icons to Ascancity, to Reeler Movie Reviewer, as Abe just said, to Unnatural Selections, to Horrorphilia, a co-podcaster that's been helpful to us, to Christy Peterson Schoonover's website, and, of course, MJ Preston's website, where you can learn about the Equinox and Arcadia event, as well as various short stories and book covers that MJ Preston has done. Now, let's see here. We have... Oh, Abe, you did mention the Facebook group, which was Dark Discussions Podcast. So just search for that out on Facebook. And at the bottom of every page of www.darkdiscussions.com are links to all those things, including the email. And we are also on Stitcher and iTunes. Now, Mike, speaking of iTunes.
If you go on to iTunes or Stitcher or some other podcasty type service type thing, and look up Dark Discussions Podcast, whatever you use to listen to this, and leave us a review. It would be greatly appreciated. It bumps up our profile, gets us noticed, raises up on the list if someone searches, say, for horror podcasts, and maybe some more people will listen to it, and maybe that gets us more exposure, and once again, we'll further our attempts to conquer the world. But we really can't do that without your help, which really makes it kind of a crappy plan. Nevertheless, help us conquer the world. Leave us a review on iTunes. It was short notice. We didn't have a lot of time.
So, Mike, what have you seen recently that are genre-related that, you know, just maybe interest listeners to the podcast?
Not a lot recently. I did watch – there's a new independent film out called Love in the Time of Monsters, which is a low-budget effort starring – which is what's most noteworthy for – starring Kane Hodder and Doug Jones. Kane Hodder, of course, known for Friday the 13th, playing Jason Voorhees, as well as the I can't remember the character's name, but the killer from the Hatchet series, amongst many, many other things in the genre. And Doug Jones, makeup performer extraordinaire, known mostly for Abe Sapien and Hellboy, done a lot of work with Del Toro. He plays one of the aliens on Falling Skies. And played one of the gentlemen on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and lots of other things. Then the basic premise of the story is it's a setup in one of these touristy trap places with a Bigfoot theme, where there are people paid to wander around dressed up as Bigfoot. And then due to some chemical contamination because of polluters, the people in the Bigfoot outfits sort of end up getting contaminated by a 28 days later slash crazy slash, you know, zombie-like virus and going on a rampage and killing people in cheesy Bigfoot outfits. Now, I got to tell you, I don't know exactly how to review the film. I do think... For what
they're
given,
just did actually.
I think for what they're given, Kane Hodder and Doug Jones are fine. The film itself is probably best enjoyed with friends and copious amounts of alcohol, or perhaps some other vegetative products. Maybe will help you through it, because I don't know that this is one to watch alone and sober. There were parts of it where it felt like I was about to give up on it, and then once the zombie squirrels came in, once the zombie squirrels and other various zombie wildlife came in, and what I can only hope were deliberately the most god-awful practical effects put on screen in the last 30 years, where I'm talking like somebody grabbed you know, cheap foam lawn ornaments or something and painted them bloody and you know, just it's pretty much you gotta see to believe it. This is something that now I know I have grabbed. Everyone is now on their edge of their seat going, but tell me how I can see this. It is available on iTunes and Amazon and Ultraviolet and all your various other streaming services. If you are interested in renting it, I can't imagine that Netflix will pass this one up. So I'm sure it'll end up being on Netflix anytime soon. But you know, you might, if you are a fan of your questionable quality horror comedies, you may want to check this one out or not. Just saying. The other thing I started watching last night and then I didn't finish. I don't know how well versed you guys are in your early 80s bad science fiction fantasy films. But I just on nostalgia picked up a quote unquote classic by the name of Krull. Are you guys familiar with Krull?
The Krull or Krull?
No. Krull. Krull. K-R-U-L-L.
Oh, Krull.
Okay.
No,
okay. Right. Yeah.
I thought you said Krull.
Krull. No, Krull.
With the spinny, spiky thing, right?
Yes, with the glaive. With the most retarded weapon ever made. A blade.
Krull,
which
yes,
is a which
yes,
is,
Krull. Yes.
And which the is a... Yes, where you have a spinny star with pointy edges that you're supposed to throw and then catch it by the sharpie pointy bits as it returns back to you.
Yeah. Has a cycle.
That was it. Starring, of course, Qui-Gon Jinn, Ra's al Ghul or whoever else you want to know. Of course, Liam Neeson has a bit part in the film. But I got to tell you, I only watched like the first half hour of it last night. I'm going to watch the rest either tonight or tomorrow. And this was a movie made for roughly $25 million in 1983, which by 1983 today, $25 million is a relatively low-budget film. 1983, that was a lot of money. And I got to give the filmmakers credit because it's hard to spend – that much money on a movie and have it come out looking that cheap. You know, catching a low budget aesthetic on a high budget film, I think takes some special talent. The fight choreography is absolutely horrid in the bits that I saw. The costumes are ridiculous. The soundtrack is basically James Horner cashing a paycheck and saying, here's my Star Trek II soundtrack. Just play that and add some extra instruments in. The acting isn't good either, although I haven't gotten to the Liam Neeson bits yet. I don't know how good he'll be because he didn't have a cell phone at that point. But, it is cheesy, and if you have an appreciation for early 80s cheese fantasy / science fiction...
You know, I watched that movie a couple years ago because I hadn't seen it yet, and I'll be damned if I can remember anything specific about it, so that... Tells you how impactful it was.
That could be your body's internal defense mechanism. because there are people out there.
Actually,
there are people. It is fun, but it is cheesy. It's sort of a poor man's Flash Gordon, and should be enjoyed in sort of a similar way, with tongue firmly planted in cheek. But you can clearly see this is the, well, Star Wars made money, so here, we'll do another hero's journey with a weird weapon.
Well, see, the difference is that Star Wars is awesome.
Yeah, and they had John Williams and not James Horner. And they had Ben Kenobi, although admittedly, they did get Liam Neeson first, so... Who are we to judge? And yeah, so that's really it that I've seen that I can think of note in recent weeks.
All right, very good. What about you, Eric?
Let's see. Dan and I watched a movie last weekend that we were pretty disappointed in. It was Monsters, Dark Continent. And we watched a preview for it, and basically looked like Army versus Aliens. So we thought that was pretty cool. And it wasn't until we were about three quarters of the way through it that I realized it was a freaking sequel to Monsters. Because the things in this movie don't look anything like the things from the first. The things in this movie don't look like anything like the ones in the first movie. And they did the same fucking thing with the trailer too, which is they made it look like it was all sorts of action-y, and it's really, really not. You'd be surprised how boring it is for a movie centered around a combat zone. So yeah, can't recommend it.
And let me guess, it has an underlying political message as well.
You think? yeah. So at least the first Monsters was saved by the quality of the actual story they were telling. Even it wasn't the one they advertised. This one is not. I recommend avoiding this one. Other than that, I watched a movie called Demon's Rook. And I'm sorry to say that I wasn't thrilled by it, but it is it's a low budget movie and actually has some, considering the budget, keep that in mind, everybody, before you scream at me on Facebook, some pretty cool practical effects. But it was clearly a low budget movie and really didn't have a plot that made a whole lot of sense. And other than that, I've been starting to plow my way through Sons of Anarchy. So I've still not listened to the episode that Mike and Phil did on it because I want to avoid spoilers. But I'm into season 4 now. Really enjoyed the first two seasons. Season 3 kind of went wonky for a little while. But now season 4 seems to be somewhat back on track.
Very good. Excellent.
I will say I was completely shocked when Gemma became the Reverend Mother. I never would have seen that one coming.
Now, Abe, what about yourself?
I saw several films in theater. The first one was Chappie. Did anyone else see that one?
Nope.
Not yet.
Yeah, it's definitely got the District 9 vibe to it. You know, it's got the same feeling when you watch it. I don't think I liked it as much as District 9. But I still thought it was a pretty fun film. I wouldn't say the story was anything special though. And its focus on the theme is kind of heavy handed.
You think from that guy?
What I'm saying is it feels more heavy handed than the District 9.
Okay.
Like it feels like someone's banging your head throughout it.
Yeah,
okay. Let me ask you a question. On the Neil Blomkamp scale, on one end you have District 9, and on the other hand you have Elysium. Where that's is this?
End. What are you talking about?
Are you kidding me?
So, which is more, though, in your opinion?
Well, I think District 9 being the good one, and Elysium, not so much. Where would would you say it's closer to District 9 or Elysium?
Okay, if I put them on a scale from 1 to 10, I think Chappie hits a 6.
So about in the middle, but a little bit more towards the District 9 side.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think it's a lot better than Elysium from what I can tell.
Okay.
You know.
I'm still planning on trying to catch it, but...
Yeah, I don't know how long it's going to be in theaters for. You know, it's been getting very mixed reviews.
Yeah, and the summer films are about to roll out because summer now begins at the start of spring.
Right. Yep. A better film I saw was Kingsman, The Secret Service,
which I thought
was fantastic. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that one did get good reviews.
I thought the acting in all parts was solid. Samuel Jackson playing the villain was different from how you expect him to play it. It's jarring when you think of Samuel Jackson. He usually plays loud, smart mouth, badass motherfuckers who curse every single sentence. In this one, he's a nerdy, baseball cap wearing billionaire with a lisp who has a craving for Happy Meals.
And can't stand the sight of blood.
And his tenth woman is amputee with bladed prosthetic legs that she cuts people in half with. If I recall correctly, this was the same guy who gave us Kick-Ass, right?
Yes.
It was. So, yeah, I mean, when you watch it, it oozes with that kind of humor and ultra violence. I had a ball of this movie. It's definitely a recommend. That was definitely way better than Chappie, in my opinion. It's definitely a film you guys have got to catch before it disappears. And I've also been reading The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, which is about the 1893 World's Fair and H.H. Holmes. It's written in a narrative form, out the background and the history of everything.
So the serial killer, yes. From actually was born and raised in New Hampshire, but he became a serial killer in Chicago.
Yeah.
One of these days, we're going to mention a human being that you do not know the background to.
Fair enough. Maybe so.
Well, it's a pretty good book. It kind of starts up slow, but it's interesting how it gives you the history, but telling you a story, in a sense, that keeps you engaged, not like reading a textbook at all.
Now, is it a brand new book?
I don't think so.
What did you say the name was?
Devil in the White City.
Yeah, it's been out for a while. Pam and I listened to the audiobook.
2003, says here.
Yeah, about 2 years ago, we listened to the audiobook. It's engaged. I know it's been optioned to be a film for years, but nobody's been able to make anything out of it.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky to do so. It's 2003, it says here. But it's a pretty good book. I haven't got too far into it to say that I would immediately recommend it, but it's got off to a good start. And other than that, that's pretty much everything.
All right, very good. For me, let's see, I rewatched a couple of older films. I got the Blu-ray of The Burning. One of our listeners, Michelle Barkley, gave it to me as a gift, as well as Only Lovers Left Alive and Motel Hell. All Blu-rays, Motel Hell and The Burning, are Scream Factory reissues that just came out, and Only Lovers Left Alive is the film from last year that you've seen, Mike. And since we don't have a PayPal button, donation button, this is how she donated to our podcast. So I have to thank her. I know you, Eric, got some stuff. And
This is how you know you have a dedicated fan, when she says, "Fuck you, you don't want donations, you're getting fucking donations, whether you like it or not." That's
true.
That's dedication.
Yes. And so I did watch The Burning, that one. I hadn't seen that film since 1981, and it was actually pretty damn good. I thought it was pretty good.
And you could see a very, very young George Costanza in that movie.
Yeah, and Holly, whatever her name is, she won an Academy Award.
Hunter?
Holly Hunter, yeah. She is in it as well, a small cameo. But yeah, that was pretty good. And then I saw Demons. I got that, the Synapse Blu-ray, and I rewatched that, and that was pretty damn good quality upgrade to Blu-ray. But then the main thing I've watched in the past 2 weeks is House of Cards. I watched seasons 1, 2, and 3. The reason I watched it was because Michelle Barkley actually texted you, Eric, or Facebooked you, saying that we should do an episode on it, right?
Right.
Yeah, and I said, "Oh, I'll check it out. I might as well finally." And yeah, it was a really good show. I enjoyed it tremendously. And unfortunately, I have to wait a whole year for season 4 because season 3 just came out end of February.
Right. Yep.
But it was real good. Characters were well written, and a very engaging show. I can see why it has won awards and has received the accolades that it has gotten. So that's pretty much it for me. Anyone else have any items of news or note or information that they wanted to share with the listeners?
Not right now.
Very well. All right. So I guess we're done for the pre-show, and I guess we can get into our main topic. So, Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we are going to be talking about the 1999 movie starring Kevin Bacon, Stir Up Echoes.
Oh, I saw a guy who got a 2-inch needle stuck into his arm while he was under hypnosis, didn't feel a thing.
Okay, Kreskin, prove it. Hypnotize somebody.
Yeah, do me.
No.
Come on. What's the worst that can happen?
Close your eyes. Close your eyes.
Why do I know that song?
Are you okay?
What the hell did she do to me?
I see a red door and I want it painted black.
He hasn't gone to work. He sleeps like 12 hours a night.
Why are you digging?
The man's switch got flipped. He's a receiver now.
She's taking him away.
She was here.
What's the problem?
Turn their heads and quickly look away. Like a newborn baby, it just happens every day.
Don't be afraid of it, Daddy.
I look inside myself and see my heart is black.
He can't stop it. He can't slow it down. He can't even figure it out.
No!
Whatever door you open in my mind, I want you to shut up.
Kevin Bacon's film Stir of Echoes, directed by a guy named David Cope, who seems to be a more of a screenwriter and script cleanup man,
right?
More than anything.
He's got a really extensive list of well-known writing credits.
He sure does. Panic Room, Spider-Man, the one that Sam Raimi did, Secret Window, the Johnny Depp film, War of the Worlds, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, Angels and Demons, Men in Black 3, just to name a few. The Lost World, Jurassic Park's another one. So, yeah, he's been around for a while. Only directed a handful of films, however. Last film he did was something called Premium Rush. And then before that,
Ghost Town. I saw that.
Oh, you did? Okay. And then Ghost Town, and then Secret Window, he actually directed that one, and then which is based off a Stephen King book, and then Stir of Echoes. By the way, Secret Window was filmed in the province of Quebec. So, Eric.
My God, even indirect Canadians have to cite Canadian crap.
I guess so. But this is French-Canadian crap. It's more important than English-Canadian crap. So, anyway.
Okay.
Well, you gotta, you know, we're over here in New Hampshire. We're all French Canadian ancestry, most of us. So, now let's see here. So, Eric, you were the one that decided to bring this up as a topic. Where did you get the idea to bring this up as a topic?
Honestly, I was sitting at breakfast at the Pancake House, and Paint It Black came on the music. And I was like, oh, I kind of want to watch Stir of Echoes again.
Oh yes,
that's really what it came down to.
All right, so that was it. That was just how it popped up. That's interesting.
It was a mental association.
He very subtly coerced us by at the end of the last podcast. It was asked, "What are we covering next week?" And he said, "How about Stir of Echoes?" And all the rest of us were, "But okay," because we couldn't come up with anything better. It was a masterful manipulation.
Yes, it was a plot.
Yeah, and that's all right, though, because oddly, it's almost as if you were reading my mind, Eric. Like 3 weeks ago, I was looking for the film on Netflix and almost rented it 3 weeks even before you mentioned the film, and it was just total coincidence. And the only reason I was doing it was because we have a episode about Kevin Bacon in another film that's coming out shortly. And so that got me into a Kevin Bacon thing, and I said, "Hey, I'll check out some of his other good genre films." And unfortunately, Netflix does not have this film available at this time. But yeah, that's why it was on my mind. The film is actually based off of a story, right, Mike?
Yes, it's based on a story by Richard Matheson, who is, of course, the author of I Am Legend. The Incredible Shrinking Man, of which there's a little Easter egg thrown in this film, and what are some other things he's done? Some classic Twilight Zone episodes, such as Terror 20,000 Feet.
The Zuni.
The Zuni fetish doll from Prey, from Trilogy of Terror. Is based on one of his. is one. Yeah, that's based on one of his short stories. So, yeah, he's got a lot of good resources. Oh, the ghost story with Roddy McDowell, Haunting of Hell House.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That was another one of his. So Matheson has a fairly distinguished catalog, and I think they've done a pretty good job of adapting his films. Maybe they're just smart at picking which books.
What Dreams May Come
was another one. Yep. You compare him to, say, I think his track record as far as adaptations go might be a little more solid than, say, Stephen King, ranges from the absolutely abysmal to the absolutely fantastic. Or certainly than, say, a Dean Koontz or poor Tom Clancy,
Tom Clancy's been better than Dean Koontz.
But Tom Clancy, it's like Hunt for Red October, and they're all going to get worse from here. And they're going to keep teasing you by making each one worse than the one before it.
All right, from the author of Red October.
Oh, he did Red Storm Rising too, which was pretty good.
So that's something that's worthwhile. And it's got a lot of actors that I haven't seen in a while, but were doing stuff. I seem to remember seeing a lot when this came out around it was 99, right?
Yeah. Well, one thing that surprised me watching this movie again is that, Kevin Bacon's wife in the movie. It's called by Catherine Erb, who's been on Law and Order Criminal Intent for a long, long time now.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of actors and actresses in this film that have had a wide range of career on television and small roles in major films, including Alina Douglas as well. And by the way, Catherine Erb and Alina Douglas are all both Bostonians. And then Jennifer Morrison has a small role in this too, and she's had a pretty decent career as well.
I don't know what else Alina Douglas has been in, but she's got one of those faces where she's like, "Oh God," she's instantly recognizable.
Well, she's the one. She's the psychic, or the hypnotist.
She actually comes from a major Hollywood family. She's like the granddaughter of Melvin Douglas. So she's been, one of those similar to the Coppolas and whatever. But one of her better roles that I've seen her in was that Nicole Kidman film, To Die For, or something like that.
That is a good movie.
Yeah, she was in that. And she's the one that skates over Nicole Kidman's head at the very end of the film, all happy because they got their revenge. And stuff.
Right.
Yeah, and then she was in other films too. Otis, Beef is a B horror film comedy, and she was in that. But go on, Mike.
She was in the remake of Cape Fear.
Yep.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I was thinking the wife I recognize because she played, I can't remember the name of the character, but she played this sort of psychopathic bitch in the HBO series Oz.
Okay.
She was like the female prisoner who gets put on death row.
Interesting.
I don't watch any of the Law and Order CSI family of films of TV series.
Wow. And, congratulations. You're like 1% of America.
I'm not saying I've never seen an episode.
I don't either, Mike. I've never seen an episode. So.
To be fair, the last time I remember watching an episode was in my grandmother's house while she was still alive, and she died before I met my wife, which tells you how long Law and Order's been on TV.
Choose this view.
If you want, that's the one with Munch, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So rather than do that, I'd rather rewatch my Homicide series, which is where Munch came from. And which, by the way, they did several crossover episodes with Law and Order, and it was always entertaining because they would always interview the actors, and they're like, why can't they write character stuff for us like they do on Homicide? Because, I don't know. Anyway, get completely off track here, but yeah, if you want a good drinking game, go to IMDb, find a living actor, and try to find one that has not been on Law and Order.
Well, even better.
Of some sort.
Even better, one actor that hasn't been in a film with Kevin Bacon. It's 6 Degrees.
Right?
And
yeah, but we're replacing 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon with 1 degree of CSI or 1 degree of Law and Order.
Okay, because
they're all on there.
So that was my way to get back on track, Mike, to bring Kevin Bacon.
And he just wouldn't let you.
He just wouldn't let me. But that's all right. So Kevin Bacon, he stars in this role, in this film, I mean, and many of the reviewers that saw this film, I looked it up, thought Kevin Bacon was fantastic, including Roger Ebert, who said it was one of his best acting roles and is the reason why he should be a leading man. Maybe not in the, you know, he's not in the Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise category, I guess, but Ebert obviously thinks that he should be otherwise. But again, he has his television show, The Following, which is highly successful on Fox, which is a genre serial killer television show, and I've enjoyed that. Now, Abe, have you ever seen this film prior to Eric suggesting us to do an episode on it?
Yeah, a while ago. I'm trying to remember when. Let's see. It came out in 1999. It was early, probably like maybe early 2000s when I first saw it. So it's been a while. So it was kind of refreshing to see this again.
Yeah, I was the same as you, Abe. The last time I had actually seen this film was when you went to the video store and got VCR tapes. And that's actually the last time I saw this film. So yeah, we're talking a long time as well. And then Eric.
Yeah, the last time I saw it, it didn't look dated at all. So it's been a while. Yeah, it's been at least 10 years.
And what about you, Eric? When was the last time you saw it? Since not including rewatching it for this episode.
Oh geez, I can't even remember. At least a decade.
Really? You as well? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I do remember when I first saw the film, I thought it was pretty good, but I wasn't overwhelmed because at that time I was sick of the stories of like The Changeling and The Sixth Sense and all those stories where
– Well, and that's
– Yeah, go on.
That's something I actually wanted to bring up is that it came out about a month after The Sixth Sense was released, so I think it got overshadowed by that movie significantly.
Yeah, that's what I read actually on Wiki and a few other places is that a lot of folks believe that the film didn't get the play that The Sixth Sense did was because it fell right after The Sixth Sense, and that is most certainly the case.
This is a film that appealed to the contrarians, you know, the ones who always have to, oh well, The Matrix wasn't that good, Dark City was better. You know, or in this case, you know, Sixth Sense isn't that good. She Stir of Echoes. Stir of Echoes is better. It's been a really long time since I've seen Sixth Sense, too. I still think probably Sixth Sense is a better film, but this is a good movie.
And to be honest, though, it came so close to Sixth Sense. Is it fair that it should even be compared to it? Because, I mean, it's a ghost story, but, I mean, it's not necessarily a carbon copy by any means, you know?
Right. I don't think they mean to say it's a carbon copy any more than Dark City was a copy of Matrix. It just happens to hit on similar themes. You know, same as The Abyss and Deep Star 6 and Leviathan all came out the same summer.
Right.
And
they do have similar themes in that they're, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen this. They do have similar themes in that there is a semi-creepy kid that sees ghosts.
Well, and to be honest, this is nothing new because like Maria Olson, this is one of the stars of Starry Eyes, she mentioned a movie that back in 1981 that kind of creeped her out when she was a kid, and that was a film called Ghost Story, which was based off of Peter Straub's book. Never mind, I brought up The Changeling, and this film and Sixth Sense take strongly from that. Those two movies, and yet I even read reviews that said even if this film came out a month after The Sixth Sense, the book was written in 1950s. So the idea is that old. It's all the way back to the 1950s.
Well, because obviously Matheson was ripping off the sperm that would one day grow up to be M. Night Shyamalan. So, yeah, obviously this is an idea that goes way, way back. It's not exactly original, probably even with Matheson necessarily, but it is certainly interesting ideas. And there are some creepy moments in it. It's an effective ghost story.
Now, let's discuss a couple things here first. First off, Abe, what was your opinion of this film when you first saw it, and what was your opinion now when you saw it?
I guess I remember liking it, but as it said, it was such my memory of it was very vague. Seeing it again, it definitely feels very dated in terms of effects and stuff like that. But the acting holds up. And while I guess maybe back then, and I'm curious, maybe because I never read the original short story or the novel, so I don't know how similar the two are. But the plot line is kind of it's very familiar to me. Probably by now, it's very familiar to me. It's a good little horror movie. I mean, I wouldn't say it's scary by any means, nor the mystery all that complex. I was able to pick up on things rather quickly, I could definitely agree with Ebert's opinion about this being one of Bacon's stronger performances. But in most things I've seen him in, he's been pretty damn good. He's a great actor. This movie overall, if I was to give it a rank, I'd say by this now, I'd say about 7. It's not above average, but it's still pretty good.
All right. And Mike, you mentioned also, you thought felt, dated, whether you meant the effects or maybe the story. I'm not sure.
It's dated in the way that it's set in 1999. And so the effects are very dated. This is, I think there might be some small use of CGI in the theater scene when she's talking, sending him back through hypnosis.
Yep.
But otherwise, it's mostly like practical sort of effects or cheap digital effects on an AV board, like where it makes the red light glow. And I'm not saying there's anything necessarily wrong with it, because it does kind of keep it as a. Because it isn't pushing, and one of the problems with those films from that period is that they went, like, say, The Haunting, which came out that same year, which went with what was then cutting-edge CGI. Those age, I think, much worse. I don't think it hurts the film in this case, because it really doesn't call for fancy effects. And it is using sort of classic stuff that, at least for people of my generation, we would consider timeless. I don't know... I don't know if Abe's generation would convert timeless to hokey and cheap, but you know, so at least for me, it works fine with that, and it's sort of weird to have a nostalgic feel on a film that was made in 1999. But yeah, and it's also it doesn't have people aren't walking around with cell phones and tweeting and texting and Facebooking, and there's no internet shit going on, for the film. So, like, there's a scene in the film where one character tells his wife to have him contact me, where now it would be just have him look me up on Facebook or send me an Instagram.
See, now, I don't think that's kind of splitting hairs if you want to call that dated. Because you can make a movie now without referencing any of that stuff, too. However, I agree. The CGI, really the CGI is really bad, and that's what dates this movie rather than anything particular to the plot, I think.
Well, I didn't see a lot of actual CGI.
The one you can notice is really, really bad, and that was the CGI missed in Breath.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
But I got to give them credit that they even did the mist in Breath for the breath in a cold room, because for example, Kill Bill Volume 1, there's a scene where Uma Thurman and Lucy, what's her name?
Lucy Liu.
Lucy Liu
are fighting in a cold garden in Japan, and when they talk, there's no breath at all. So, and that always jars me every time I watch Kill Bill Volume 1. And at least I got to give credit here that they at least tried to do it, even if you could tell that it was computer generated. For the other things that Mike was talking about, texting and cell phones and all that, that didn't bother me at all because
– No, I'm not saying that. You know, no, I didn't say that bothered me. I'm saying that dates the film.
It didn't really bother me much because, for example, the film was made in 1999 just as like Taxi Driver was made in 1975 or whatever, and Midnight Cowboy was 1969, whatever. And those were the periods that they filmed. So in other words, this is a film of a period piece. You know what I'm saying? So it didn't feel odd that these characters didn't have a phone or something. Because what they could have done, had they just put up like a placard or a text over the film that said June 3rd, 1999 or something. And then, you know.
Oh, yeah, but you see, here's the thing. If you make a move, the odds are, unless you work really hard at it, if you make a movie now, for example, set in 1976, and then you showed that to a person next to Taxi Driver, I don't think they would have much trouble being able to tell you, this was the one made in 1976, and this is the one made in 2015, set in 1976. Right?
Okay.
And so this is clearly in that era, right? It's in that 99 era. And again, it's mostly the effects that still call out. And the effects are really, most of them are pre-CGI. There's a very little bit of CGI. But most of them are things like, you know, the flashing red lights, right? When he's walking to the ball game.
That was probably the most jarring one, I think. The rest, even if they were dated, they worked well. But the red one, that seemed like it was more of a cheap effect than even anything.
Right, but it's a ghost story, and a lot of times the cheap effects work well for some reason in a ghost story. It's not that big a deal. I wasn't saying, like, but the things like, well, there's no cell phones, that it was in any way detracting, but it just, anything where you're having no acknowledgement of computers, and it's actually just something I realize how much that there's a demarcation at some point where computers are now so prevalent, and computers and tablets and all this other stuff are so prevalent in films that are made now. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just a cultural thing because they're all around us for everything. You know, I know I've told this story before. It was like how I remember at some point, probably around 2000 or so, I was watching Halloween, and at one point in the movie, the phone's ringing, and I'm like, just why isn't the answering machine picking it up? I was like, oh right, 1978. You know, it's like you know. So it's a similar sort of thing. You just forget that these technologies didn't necessarily all exist back in the time that the films were made.
Now, there was a film last year, A Walk Among the Tombstones, which is a pretty good film, and that is a period piece, so it takes place in like 1979 or something like that. I forget what year. It may have been 1985, I don't know. But either way, it was made last year, and it takes place, you know, 20, 15 years, 30 years ago or whatever. And there's a scene where the Liam Neeson character sits down in front of a computer, a desk in a library, and looks through news articles that are on microfilm.
Microfiche. Yeah.
Okay. And then you have newer films where you people instead wouldn't do that. You know, if it was taking place today, they would have it going through the internet. They go to, you know, Google or Ying or Bing or whatever, and then type in something, and boom, they would start reading about a girl that died in the neighborhood or whatever. Oddly, this film, like you said, Mike, this film doesn't have the internet because it took place in 1999, but it doesn't have Kevin Bacon going to a library either to do his own research. What do you think of that? Because that could have been in other words, if it was made today, he probably would have been on the internet Googling stuff. And
I don't know. The Kevin Bacon character doesn't seem like much of a library guy to me.
Right?
That's no, he's not exactly the brightest bulb in the shed.
Well, he seems like he's a smart guy. He's just not a book guy.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, that's true, because, I mean, we discover that he is, his character is, works on the power lines, and he actually even insults his job, saying that all I do is cut wire, and any monkey can do that. And this is him speaking, not me. And she, his wife says, oh, but, well, soon you're supposed to go to a desk job soon, you know, become a manager or whatever. And he, and then he just, you know, reminisces how he goes, well, I just haven't turned out to what I was hoping, and so on and so forth. So in that sense, you guys are right. So, yeah, he's definitely not a book guy, but as we discover throughout the film, he's a pretty, pretty bright guy. So what else do we want to talk about before we start talking about specific aspects of the film? I mean, obviously, we're talking about the effects. We discussed the acting, things like that. Any further things before we throw up a spoiler alert or anything?
Well, since this figures very early into the film, and I guess we could save it for that point, but hypnosis plays a big part in the movie. So yeah. I want to know, have any of you been hypnotized?
No.
Nope.
I have not either, no. I've never been to one of those hypnosis shows to see other people get hypnotized. The only hypnotism I've ever seen is like in the movies like The Exorcist or this film.
Okay. Because I got it. I had it done at one of those shows when I was in college. You know, they have the various things to distract students from how miserable their lives are. And so I went to one show, and I was one of the, you know, dozen or so people on the stage. Didn't really work on me. I just couldn't. I guess I just have too many control issues. I just couldn't let go, you know. So, I mean, you'd get some of it, and I understand hypnosis is a thing. It is a real thing, and it's a state of mind we often go into, and we've all been through that, you know, well, most of us, maybe not Abe, like when you're driving someplace and you realize you got from point A.
Yeah,
and you're like, did I stop at the stop sign? I don't even remember anymore, you know? Oh, my God. Was that a bump or was that a person I ran over? What happened? You know, it's like you just don't remember. It's like, you know you did it, but yeah, you're spaced out. And that's really all hypnosis basically is. But I was just wondering if anyone's had that experience, because I'm one of those people. I just don't know that I'm hypnotizable, or it wasn't that one night. But I certainly know people who could be.
Hypnosis did not work for you.
Not really, no. Got me really relaxed, but at no point, like, did I lose the sense of surroundings, and I never forgot what happened and what transpired, and I never felt I was out of control of what I was doing. Right, so it didn't really do much other than just get me kind of really, you know, in a good sort of space. You know, just which any good meditation will probably end up doing.
Sure. We'll just throw a spoiler out here now, just in case we say anything that could ruin the film. But if anybody wanted to watch the film prior to listen to the rest of this episode, this is the time to shut off, watch the film, and then come back. Now, Eric, what was your opinion of this film now that you've rewatched it?
Well, you know, it's not quite as good as I remembered it, but it's still good.
Okay. What do you think resulted in it? Is it because
I think part of it is because the first time you watch the movie, you don't already know what's transpiring. And so having that little, you know, as Abe was saying, it's not entirely unpredictable. But at the same time, not knowing for sure gives you that little edge of mystery when you're watching it for the first time, which elevates it. And Kevin Bacon's performance is pretty awesome in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure is. Yeah, for me, like I said, I actually wasn't looking forward to necessarily watching the film again, because again, I was like so when I first saw it, because it's kind of the same plot as, you know, The Changeling or The Ghost Story or Sixth Sense, even though it's a little different, but the general same idea. However, rewatching it, I was actually pleasantly surprised. I really got into the film after the first 20 minutes when the mystery started. I enjoyed it a whole lot, and it was fairly new to me because even though I remembered the digging, and it was something about digging in the film, I had forgotten the film generally, and then when all of it happened at the end, it was fresh as if I had never seen the film prior. Nice. So I was kind of happy about that. I thought it was pretty good. It's definitely something people should watch, and if you love Kevin Bacon, this is definitely one of his roles that he really shines, especially the last hour of the film. How do we want to start? What do we want to talk about first?
Can I ask, is Kevin Bacon's performance really good, or is it just that he has an accent that makes us think he was really good?
No, it was pretty good. There's one moment in particular that caught my attention while I was watching it last night. It's a scene where one of the things that happens during this movie is that Kevin Bacon's character starts to become obsessed, and he's not even sure what he's obsessed about, but he's obsessed. And he has this unquenchable thirst, and he's constantly just drinking orange juice, constantly. Orange juice, he's drinking the orange juice. And so there's one point in the movie where he kind of gets a little fight with his wife, and he's trying to make up with her. He's trying to be nice. And so he decides to share his orange juice with her. So he brings two glasses over to the table and pours what's left of the carton of orange juice equally into the two glasses and immediately chugs his in like less than a second flat. And he sits there and his wife is sitting across the table like reading a letter or something. And he's just sitting across from her looking at her, and in the span of about a second and a half, he looks at her, looks at the orange juice, 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 and goes, "You gonna have that?"
And swallowed that down too.
So he's trying really hard to be nice and share his orange juice, and then after a second and a half can't stand it, then he doesn't have more and takes it away from her. I thought that was a really awesome moment.
Well, that's one of the things I liked is that from the writing perspective, I guess this is writing, he's crazy, but he's not aware so much that what he's doing is crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, why wouldn't I be drinking all this orange juice?
Right. What's your problem? Orange juice is good.
This is jumping ahead, but when he's digging and she's like, "What are you doing?" Right. I'm watering the ground to make it softer. So he's like, "Okay, you're missing..."
That's not what I'm asking you.
That's not the crazy part. Okay.
The writing, the acting together. I mean, Mike, you've always said that it comes down to not necessarily the writer or not necessarily the actor, but it comes down to the number of takes and then taking the best take. And, you know, they obviously got the really good takes for this. And that's where we get some – I mean – it's always easier to write, they say, drama than comedy. And even though this is by no means a comedy, the comedic elements from Kevin Bacon's sister-in-law, which is the Alina Douglas character, and her comments and her snarkiness, to Kevin Bacon going about this mystery and not even knowing that he's being, dragged forward by this new found telekinesis or whatever it's called that he has, and he becomes this quirky character, and so there is comes humorous moments in it. What did you guys think of the Kevin Bacon character all in all? I mean, Abe, you mentioned something about that you thought he wasn't necessarily the brightest bulb, but then I mentioned
I kind of come some slack considering he's suffering from insomnia and dehydration and stuff like that, but sometimes the way he goes about dealing with certain things is just like, man, couldn't you think that through a little better? Like when he starts going around during the I don't know what would you call it, the football festival, what the hell is going, I can't remember what we would call it, but he's asking around about the girl, and when they ask him why he's asking, he just doesn't come up with a good reason as to why, and he starts raising suspicions so easily.
Yeah, you know? Sure. Yeah, what did he say? He goes, I forget what he said, but something like, I was just thinking about it the other day for no reason.
A lot, yeah. I've been thinking about her a lot. And everyone just kind of looks at him like, okay. You know, he didn't come with a decent explanation on just some kind of little plan to try to not make him seem so sketchy, you know, considering the – I think this was soon after the outburst with the babysitter.
Right, that's exactly right. It was right after that. It was at a at the party, like you said. It's almost like a street party or a block party or something. Now, Eric, this is where Abe brought up a good point about the girl and such. The main, even though the plot is, I guess, centered around Kevin Bacon and his character and I guess his family, it really, the movie doesn't exist without this girl that Abe mentioned.
Right.
So why don't you let folks know what we're talking about here? What is this girl that we're talking about?
Well, that's kind of the mystery.
Well, the spoiler warning's out there, so.
Yeah, it's okay. We did put a spoiler warning out. Well, basically, as it turns out, after an hour and a half of movie, we find out that there was this girl who is I mean, they refer to her in the movie. In the movie, I'm quoting, folks, don't write nasty letters. She's referred to in the movie as retarded. And we find out that there were some of the local boys kind of lured her into a house. And she actually did give them permission to kiss her. But they decided that they wanted more, and she wasn't cool with that. And so basically, they raped her and then inadvertently killed her, trying to keep her quiet. They ended up suffocating her. And so her body got walled inside the house that Kevin Bacon has been living in because the parents decided to cover up the crime for their kids.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the whole film. I mean, that's why when I compared this film to The Changeling, for example, it's kind of similar to that in the sense there's a little kid that was killed, thrown in a well, buried, whatever, and comes to haunt, seems malicious, but in reality is just asking someone that is in the living that can see them, basically give them justice. And, Kevin Bacon is the one, the hypnosis, Mike, you said, that's pretty much what sparks his, what type of power is it?
It's some sort of, it wouldn't be telepathy, like, second sight or, third eye.
That was kind of one of the clever things about the movie, though, is that one of the things he promises his sister-in-law when she hypnotizes him is that he promises to have an open mind. And that's exactly what happens, is that when she hypnotizes him, she opens his mind to all that's out there. That if it's out there and some people can see it and some can't, you might say that the rest of us block it out. So her hypnotism opens his mind so he's receptive to these things.
Yeah, she says something along the lines of, you will be open to everything around you.
Uh-huh.
And that's – now, the thing is, you know, this is like telling the bad joke where – oh, didn't I mention she was a blonde? Is that it starts out with the sun, literally the first shot of the film, is the sun is talking to the camera.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And saying, can I ask you a question?
Uh-huh.
And so he's talking to us, and then, you know, does some interplay with Dad, and then we've come back to him at the end of the scene, and he said, looks back at the camera and says, it's something like, does it hurt being dead?
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, thank God he didn't say, I can see dead people. But so you immediately, okay, so you know that. So it's the fact that they already established to a degree that he's got a son who has some psychic ability or clairvoyance, right? Would that be it? Maybe clairvoyance?
Yeah. I don't know if that's the right word. I'm not familiar enough with the definition.
No, clairvoyance is predicting the future, isn't it?
I don't know.
He's psychic. Whatever it
he
is.
One could say he has a sixth sense.
Oh, he's got the shining, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it in The Shining. We've seen it in The Sixth Sense. It's basically some sort of power where he can see either dreams, see the future, see what, I mean, it's really not specified, right? I mean, it appears that it's a mix of a number of different psychic type of things.
Right, but because it's his son, right, so then it makes some sense that this is a family thing. That this is something that runs in his family. He just wasn't very adept at it necessarily until his sister-in-law, right? Because it was a sister. Right, it was his wife's sister.
Yes, that's right.
Right, put the whammy on him, and completely screwed him up unexpectedly, because nobody knows except for the audience that they have a crazy child on their hands. So that's sort of where that gets into that. So that justifies the that why that one line, it might have, it wouldn't do the same thing, say, if Eric or I or Abe were hypnotized, because this isn't necessarily, unless this is something that, was a family trait.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, right? We find out later in the film that the son got it from him, and the son just has it more than him for whatever reason. Because we will discuss the cop at the cemetery, and it almost was identical. It reminded me very much of the cook in The Shining. Whether you read the book or the movie, the principle is the same. Where this little boy in The Shining can read people's thoughts and all these other things, see the future and whatever. And suddenly the cook at the hotel can read his mind, and he goes, "You have The Shining just like me." And I mean, am I right, Eric? Right?
Well, I was watching some of the director's commentary last night, and he didn't specifically refer to that, but there were a few different things in the movie where he's like, "Yeah, I took this from this other movie, and hey, you say ripoff, I say homage."
Well, but this is also where it would be interesting to know, really, where did all this come from? Because is it from the script, or is it from, or is it from the original story? Because again, 1958, and we know Stephen King knows his horror, and he's a big fan of Matheson.
Right.
So, is this something that Matheson created that Stephen King ripped off?
That's an interesting question.
Or is this something that, that wasn't in the novel originally and then got put in there to make it more like something that Stephen King wrote?
Mm-hmm.
Which is it? Who knows? Because we have to read the book to find out, and we've got too much shit to do. So we're not going to do that. But, but again, I think you can take the threads. Like we just mentioned, the Changeling, The Shining, Sixth Sense. Well, Sixth Sense, of course, is contemporary with this. But this is the whole genre is littered with a lot of bits and pieces. And this is just, as I said before, a good example of a story that takes those bits and pieces, doesn't necessarily do anything daring with it.
Right.
But does something competent with it, tells it well.
And so I mentioned earlier that what spurred me to want to watch this movie again is I heard the song Paint It Black come on the radio by the Rolling Stones. And that song plays a fairly prominent part in this movie because they're doing it badly enough that you can't tell what it is when they're doing it, but the son is humming it throughout the movie, and Kevin Bacon starts to figure out how to play it on guitar. But they're doing it badly enough that you can't quite identify the song until the very end of the movie, when you figure out that when the girl was dying, they were playing that song on the radio, and they turned it up really loud so that people wouldn't hear her screaming. And so that's why the Painted Black comes into it.
It just feels a little weird that a guy that admits he was in a rock band can't recognize Painted Black. that's not exactly an obscure guitar.
No, riff, I had the same thought myself, Mike. I did.
Well, For me, it didn't bother me because it's like you said, Eric, the son is like doing it like a young kid would do it. Like, so he's bastardizing it a bit.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I could see that, but, you know, hey, maybe I'm giving too much credit.
Well, and the funny thing is that, again, according to the commentary I was watching last night, it was supposed to be the Doors song, Break On Through.
Really?
Oh, that's cool.
But they couldn't get the rights to it. So they had to change it, and they actually had to go back and redo the scenes with the guitar and redo the sound on the scenes with the kid humming.
Wow, that's too bad.
Probably should have got those rights ahead of time then.
Yeah, lesson learned, huh?
Yeah, that's crazy.
But lesson learned, too late.
I don't know why they wouldn't give it to him. It's kind of ridiculous when you think about it. Bizarre.
Well, this would have been 99. I don't know.
Well, let's put it this way. I don't know if they couldn't get it or they didn't have the budget to pay for what was needed.
That could have been it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? But that's curious. So the director's commentary on the disc is well worth listening to, then, Eric.
Huh? Oh yeah. Yeah, it sure is.
All right. That's cool. So hopefully, keep on giving us those gems as we discuss the film. Let's talk about the cop and that interesting scene, because that pretty much gets us from Kevin Bacon having these weird like dreams and visions to the point where now we know, okay, we know that it's more than you know, just some fluky plot point. It's actually something that people have.
Well, I did want to say, while you're on the funky visions, they do hit two of my buttons in this. And I know I'm not the only ones. And it's not that it's not the rape or the Rolling Stones. It's the tooth.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. The fingernail.
The fingernail.
And the fingernail.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is about people where it's... You could do what you want to the forearm, but the tooth...
Yeah.
And the fingernails.
Well, here's another tidbit for you, Phil, off the commentary. The sound effect they use for the fingernail snapping off was celery crunching.
Yeah.
Nice. Now, let's now go into that scene. All right,
the cop.
Explain the scene about the cop and what happens there.
There's a cop.
Played by Scatman Crothers. No.
No, no, no. But the mom and the son wander over into a funeral at the cemetery, and the kid sees this black cop and waves at him, and the guy tries to discreetly wave back, even though he's participating in a funeral.
Oh, yeah.
And then they go away to look some other part of the cemetery, and the cop wanders over, and I forget exactly what he says.
What you talking about, Willis? No, that wasn't it.
But he says something along the lines of, "Your kid's got some sort of sense of things, doesn't he?" And basically tells her to send his husband to a certain place to find out more. And then when he's on his way to leave, the kid calls him by name, calls him Neil, even though he never introduced himself by his first name. So clearly the kid's got a little bit of psychic in him because he figured out what it was.
Yeah, exactly. And then, as I discussed earlier, the cop says, "I don't see it in you," meaning the mother. So right. The father must have it. And the mother goes, yeah. And so now she's slowly beginning to believe as well. I mean, obviously, you know, she pretty much was with her husband, you know, supporting him and all that. But when the cop says the boy has it, and the cop says, "You don't have it, but your husband must if the boy has it."
Right.
She's now kind of on board as well now, which I think was a cool way to get somebody else involved. I mean, it was convenient in a sense because, you know, the boy runs right into the guy at a funeral. But if they didn't have a scene like that, it would be kind of hard to have someone believe the going ons of some crazy guy saying that there's a girl in the house, there's a ghost, blah blah blah, and all this other stuff, I think. So I thought that was a good plot device, even if it was convenient.
Right.
One of the things I do like in the film is that they do give something for both the husband and the wife to do. Right? They're both investigating this in their, but sort of, and while doing things in their own way. And that she's trying to help her husband, and her husband's trying to pursue whatever is obsessing them, what the ghost is pushing him to do. I didn't ever feel like, which sometimes happens, you know, that they completely separated the character off in their own story, or just had them do nothing and except stand by and be useless. And what are you doing? I don't understand. You know, they don't have.
But, and there's a fair amount of that going on here, to be fair.
But she's still more proactive, and I did buy the relationship between the characters.
No, they did establish that relationship really well.
And I think that did a good job with that. And you did get that this wasn't. Because you always run the risk that we want to watch Crazy Kevin Bacon.
Right.
We want him to do, we want him to tear his house down to the foundation to find the rotting corpse beneath.
Well, and there's another, you were making a reference to the scene in the backyard earlier, Mike. There's a scene where, he just all of a sudden gets the impression through a hypnotic state or a dream that, he's supposed to dig. So he starts digging up the backyard, and his son's back there helping him, and he's digging up the backyard, and the wife comes home and just finds her backyard torn up to shit. She just goes up to him and goes, she's like, what are you doing? He's like, digging. It's like, well, no shit. And so then he picks up the hose and he sprayed it, and she goes, why are you doing that? And like you said earlier, he goes, well, it makes the dirt softer. And she's like, no, not why are you spraying the water? Why are you taking out the backyard?
And another good line at that point too, Eric, was, you know, Kevin Bacon is basically saying that he's digging for the girl, the girl that has been missing.
Did he go as far as to say that?
Well, he kind of alludes to it.
He pretty much alludes to it,
And this is the reason why he alludes to it, because then he goes, oh, don't worry. You know, because he's talking about his son, and he points over at his son. He goes, oh, don't worry. She's not buried over there.
Well, it's not over there. She never says she. She just says it's not over there.
Yeah. Meaning the kid isn't going to dig up a corpse, you know? So don't worry. Even though he's helping.
And actually, I did like that. What are you doing? He's helping. What's he doing? He's helping. Well, Eric, you have cats. I mean, we have this conversation off with my wife. It's you try to make the bed and the cat jumps on the bed. What's he doing? He's helping.
Yeah.
They're helping. So it's laughing at that, but the point is the wife wasn't just, you know, that she wasn't just like the Skylar White or your, you know, standing or the Lori Grimes just standing there, but don't do what the audience wants to watch you doing.
Right.
You know, she's out there trying to figure out a way to help her husband. Now she's trying to help her husband not be crazy. You know, but you know, it was a nice.
There's a couple of really nice moments when they get into the relationship between these two, because he made this comment at the beginning of the movie, and then again during this scene, he says something about how he doesn't want his life to end up being boring. She's like, you know what? Fuck you. Every time you talk about your boring life, you're talking about me. So shut up.
Yep. That was awesome moments.
And then, and eventually she has to leave to go to a funeral. And Kevin Bacon is still furiously digging away, and he's getting more and more pissed off because he's not finding anything. And there's an awesome moment where he gets all fed up and kicks a bucket, and he kicks this bucket at the house, and it smashes a window, and he storms into the house. And here's another tidbit from the director's commentary, is that was not planned. The breaking window was completely unscripted. He just got really lucky with that one shot. And they actually broke a window in that house. And luckily, Kevin Bacon stayed in character and continued to storm into the house so they could use the shot.
That was awesome. When that happened, I was not expecting that, and it looked as if it was set perfectly similar to like the Breaking Bad pizza moment.
Yeah. Right.
It actually also reminds me of the scene in the Two Towers where Aragorn kicks a helmet, and turns out the actual scream that he did was when he actually broke his toe doing so.
Oh, no kidding.
You just kept filling him as he screamed.
And so, that's the thing, like, right? It's like some takes unexpected turn out to be the best ones.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
Well, there was that your one of your favorite movies, Phil, the Clint Eastwood film.
Unforgiven?
No, Sean Penn.
Oh,
Mystic River.
Yeah,
right, where they're sitting in the diner, and as they're talking, I think it's Sean Penn just spills over like a carton of milk.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and that was unscripted, and it was unplanned, but he's cleaning you up, and he continues to stay in character, and you know, it adds a little bit of authenticity to it, right? It's, well, shit happens in life that you don't expect.
Right, that's an excellent point. Yeah, absolutely. And it was one of the, you know, just some of those gems versus, you know, I mean, we've heard many times where actor ad-libs, and it was so good the director keeps it in, even though it wasn't in the screenplay, from I'm walking here, to...
Stand By Me, the deer on the train tracks. That was completely arbitrary. It just, they were filming, the deer is on the tracks, and they said, shoot it. I mean, with the camera.
Yeah.
just to be clear. And it wasn't part of it, and people like want to read all this stuff into, you know, what did it mean? And it was, well, it meant that they had a good shot.
Right.
Now, probably still you could argue it had some significance, right, to the film overall, and could maybe tie, which is why it seemed like a good idea to keep it.
Yep. But it wasn't planned.
But it was completely unplanned.
Right. Yeah. Now, what other parts of the film really stuck out? Did you guys think? I mean, it actually was a fairly short film, wasn't it? It was like
100 minutes.
Yeah. So it wasn't too long, but that's the thing, is that this film could have been longer because they could have had Kevin Bacon go and actually visit the cop, and you know, have a whole subplot there and stuff like that. But really, that was just, for example, a thing to get the wife and also for the audience to understand what was going on, that whole scene, and pretty much that was the end of the cop and his subplot. But I mean, this film could have been easily an hour and 20 minutes or something like that, but they chose to make it a quick streamlined film. Did you guys think that the neighbors were developed good enough?
Didn't spend much time with them, in my opinion.
Yeah, really? Okay. Explain it. What made you think that? Well,
aside from Frank, the other ones were just kind of there, you know, they had maybe like one or two scenes. You kind of saw, you know, there was that scene they during the, I guess, the football celebration, and then one scene of the other father kind of looking out as he could hear Kevin Bacon jackhammer in the basement floor. I actually thought it was kind of hilarious because he started grumbling to himself to how it was a rented house. But other than that, even the kids didn't get much attention either. So honestly, I didn't really know much about them, you know, aside from their participation in the actual crime. But other than that, I knew nothing else. Except maybe Frank was a bit of a lecher, and, you know, his wife kind of got a little, was annoyed with him once, with his actions and stuff.
Well, they have a very passive-aggressive marriage.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the most I got out of at least the McCarthys. But, you know, the Damon family, nothing really.
Right. So the Damon family are the owner of the house that the Kevin Bacon's family lives in, and they they're the renter. They live across the street, and they rent out to them. And the is it the Mahoneys or the Murphys?
McCarthy.
Something Irishy.
McCarthy.
So the McCarthys, they're like a family that's like three or four houses down, and they're one of the more prominent families on the block, where Kevin Bacon is good buddies with the husband. And so the neighbors obviously play an important role in the film. I know, for example, on Wikipedia, and it links me to Ebert's review of the film, he actually specifically says, and this is a quote from his review, if I can find it here. He goes, Cope's, that's a director and screenwriter, Cope's screenplay dovetails the supernatural stuff with developments among the neighbors, which are wisely more sad and tragic than sensational. Well, obviously, what Ebert's trying to say, at least in my opinion, is that he's trying to say that what appears to be a normal, healthy, happy neighborhood, and it's said many times in the film because McCarthy keeps on saying this is the best neighborhood in the city, and you know, and on and on and on, and it's said like three or four times. In reality, there's rot in the neighborhood, and people and things that have occurred aren't what they really are. Mike, I know you sometimes get into the artsy-fartsy stuff. Did you think this was overplayed, or do you think they got it just enough without shoving it in our face that, you know, everything isn't the American Beauty thing?
Once you kind of get the reveal, right? I mean, you already have that sort of, because when the All-American, right, the nephew shoots himself, you know, and it's talking about how he's a great football player. He's going to be better than I am. He's going to be better. He's going to go much further than I ever did, right? And, you know, and then we'll find out later why, but I don't even know that you ever had to find out why, because that's an unfortunate reality of the world we live in, is that you don't need to have raped and killed somebody in order to commit suicide or attempt to. You know, there's always the idea that everybody's got some unhappiness going on beneath the surface. I don't know that it was that artfully handled, because I mean, throughout the film, you have the brother's wife giving snide remarks about how he can't keep his dick in his pants. So it's not like they were being subtle and nuanced about it. And when we get to the ending, you know, suddenly now the neighbors they see him find the body, and so they all break out their black mustaches and start twirling. And that's what undercuts this, because there is something. Look, first of all, let's be straight up. The crime that was committed is not an understandable crime. That is not a tragedy in terms of, right. You know, there was, right. And there was a deliberate act and of stupidity and malice, and you know, because they raped a mentally handicapped girl that they apparently, from what they've been probably teasing and maybe bullying or something throughout her younger school years before she got tits.
Yeah.
And right. Now that she's hot, they want her. And being teenage boys, they apparently don't think through well, how do we stop her from telling anybody after we rape her?
Right.
Because then they kill her, and they go, oh, well, I guess it turned out well, because she was, I can't tell anybody now. The tragedy is, I think, on the part of the parents, where I could feel for the parents, and if not condone what they do, understand it, because they want to save their children, who did something horrible and evil and stupid, but they're their kids.
Right.
And I can empathize, therefore, with the brother-in-law, with the brother, rather, who just wants to save his son. He wants to help his son. He couldn't do anything to help the girl. And I think if this was taken, which I mentioned before, if this was put in front of a jury, if I was on the jury, I would have a hard time not being sympathetic to the dad. I'm not saying that I wouldn't convict for whatever crime he would be convicted of. But, you know, here's this poor guy. His son has committed suicide over the guilt. He tried hiding the crime, which was bad, sure. But he did it out of love for his son. But once the other guys turn into, again, the mustache twirlers, and well, all right, Kevin Bacon solved the crime. Time to go grill us some bacon. You know, it's like, okay, well, now you're not sympathetic characters anymore, because now you're just as evil as the shitty children that you raised in the first part of the film.
And the moral of the story is children are shitty.
And?
Adults are shitty. Everyone is shitty.
Right.
Everything is shit when you...
Right. Because, Mike, you pretty much summed it up. Because, I mean, the moment that the kids... it's not told specifically what happens, but it is implied that the two boys, or at least one of the two boys, tells their parent, and then either that parent then tells the other parent of the other boy, or both parents are told specifically by their own boys what happened. And at that moment, the adults have a choice to make, and I think it's just specifically the males, because I don't think the female, so meaning the wives, have know anything about what happened. But the two fathers are now have a quandary to decide whether or not to go to the police and say that this has happened, you know, manslaughter or maybe even second-degree murder or whatever, and also possible sexual assault, because you said raped, and they were pretty close, but they didn't get there, but it's definitely a sexual assault. So,
well, because they killed her, they just happened to have the decency not to rape the person they murdered.
I'm not trying to defend anything, Mike. All I'm saying is that I'm trying to just say the legal terms, which is sexual assault and either third or second-degree murder.
It was more second degree. They didn't plan for it to happen.
Right. So
what would the fathers be convicted of? Just obstruction of justice, right?
Yeah.
They could be accessory after the fact.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's close to, yeah.
And honestly, I think the fathers, or at least certainly the brother, I think would have been willing to go to prison for his son. It was that he didn't want his son. Because the son would have. Let's say they get 20 years, which might have been on the low side, or even 10. They're still going to probably be labeled as sex offenders.
Right.
Yeah.
They're
young athletes with scholarships coming in. Their lives are fucked if this goes right. It's not a case of, well, this is a crime that people will forgive or forget, and they can just restart in 10 years when they get out of prison. They serve their time.
It's not like they were shoplifting.
Yeah, this is something that will hang over them forever, and especially if they go into prison as raping and murdering a retarded girl, they're not going to have a fun time in prison.
They might get a little vitamin R themselves.
Yeah. Jeez.
So I understand that, yes, the right thing to do, and I've had to say this a lot this week, the right thing to do is always the right thing to do, but it isn't necessarily the easy thing to do. And I can understand a parent saying, I feel terrible at what they did. They say they feel bad about it. Why should I ruin their lives? They made a mistake by intentionally sexually assaulting this girl. It doesn't hold up to logical scrutiny, but we're talking about a parent and a child. That's not logic.
Right. And a lot of times when it comes to parents and child, it's not logical. It's in the blood.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing is interesting about it is that whether, again, this is not shown, so we don't know what happens, whether one father, bullies the other father to help cover up the thing, or whether they both are together to do it or whatnot. The problem is that at least one of the fathers feels it has been living for 6 months since that's when the girl disappeared, with this guilt trip of covering up a murder, basically breaking every moral belief that he has, because he's in no way a sociopath. I mean, he was the type of guy that like saw his son's life about to be ruined and had a choice, and his choice was to cover it up even though he knew it was wrong, and 6 months later it's eating him up because he knows it's wrong and he feels terrible about what happened to the girl, versus the other father who
is willing to kill people to shut him up.
Yeah, is most certainly a sociopath. May have bullied the McCarthy guy into helping to cover up and said, if you go to the cops, you know, I'm going to kill you. Who knows? We don't know what happens. But, it, you know, many interpretations. Eric, for example, what would you think probably occurred? I mean, again, it's all off screen. Did the director say anything in the commentary of what screenwriter? What?
No, not really. But I pretty much agree with your take on that. The one guy was clearly in charge, and I can see him pushing everybody else into it. And even at the end, when they go after Kevin Bacon, you can tell the son's not the initiator. He's along for the ride. The only reason he's going along with it is because he's afraid of his dad.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, we definitely know that one of the two boys, the McCarthy boy, obviously felt horrible and guilty as well because he basically attempts to suicide and may actually die because the film ends before we know whether or not he dies or
yeah, it was less uncertain as to what was going to happen to him. Even if he recovers, you know, he's probably going to have to face charges.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's honestly is a tragedy, and Ebert obviously felt deeply when he watched it based off of his review. Any what did you guys feel? Did you guys feel sad about this, or you just said, oh, typical assholes?
I felt bad for the parents, but you know, I was definitely enraged, you know, at what those two little shits did to her. You know, at first they're shocked, but then the son of the what the hell was his name? God damn, he was only Harry Damon, the other father. You know, his son was actually kind of chuckling after they killed the girl.
Oh yeah.
You know, it was like I never seen a dead body before, man. And they started chuckling about it. I mean, but Adam, you know, he was clearly like the less stoic of the two, because he was absolutely freaking out.
Yeah.
You know, so it came no surprise that he tried to blow himself away. Which, what the hell, did he shoot himself in the chest?
Yeah, that was weird.
That sounds like, if you're trying to kill yourself, I mean, I think there's a much more effective area to aim for. It just made no sense.
Yeah, no, that's true.
So what about you, Phil? How did you feel about him?
Both ways, and let me explain. First, you know, how Abe said some of the characters, we didn't really feel strongly about them. I mean, they had their scenes at the beginning where they had a couple of the block party, the football game, the house party, and then the hypnosis party, and all those things. And yet I still didn't really feel strongly about these characters. And to be honest, both of the fathers just seemed like the typical dumb jock, you know, idiots that I wouldn't hang out with, not because they're dumb jocks, but because they're just dumb. And and so it was like, you know, they'd be my neighbors. I say hi on the street, but it definitely wouldn't be people I'd be hanging out with anyway. So I didn't really necessarily like the characters if I didn't hate them. But then the tragedy in finding out why the kid shot himself in the head, in the chest, and then thinking the father then shot himself in the head, and then we find out he didn't, but he admits how he's been living 6 months with this pain of covering up a horrible crime, not only of the death of a girl, but also the ruinization of his son's life, whether or not he was caught or not. So that definitely was there. But again, the film was only an hour and 40 minutes, so it didn't develop that. And of course, that was more of a subplot than the mystery and such. Yeah, go ahead.
And that's one of the things I had an issue with upon revisiting this movie is they're down in the basement where the girl's body is, right? And the guy tells Kevin Bacon to get out, and then he leaves and you hear gunshots, so you're assuming the guy kills himself. Ends up showing up later to save the day. How much time passed?
It was about 4 or 5 minutes, I think.
It was really that fast. I got the impression that more time had passed.
Oh, I was thinking film time. I don't.
God,
meaning in real time, not within the movie.
In real time, within the story of the movie.
Well, he heals fast. He's like Wolverine.
No, my point is, how long was he standing down there in the basement after he didn't shoot himself? And what the hell was he doing down there until he finally decides to wander up and, oh, hey, what's going on up here, guys?
Maybe he was curled up into a ball, kind of stuck in his thumb until he decided he mustered the strength to go back up.
Maybe he was trying to figure out how he missed.
Well, yeah, that's my thing. I was like, if he decided not to do it, then why did he fire the gun?
Or it was like, maybe he was going to shoot himself, but then he just kind of pushed out the last minute and just shot at the ground in frustration.
Like, I think it's
I put the gun to my head, I pulled the trigger, there was a bang noise.
Then again, keep in mind, his son.
How did I admit? I don't get it.
Keep in mind, his own son aimed for his chest. Perhaps it's hereditary.
But his son was successful in putting himself into a coma.
It's a family trait. Nobody knows how to shoot themselves right.
But, Eric, I agree with that because, you know, at the point when you hear the gunshot and he's in the basement and Kevin Bacon's not in the basement, you assume he blew his brains out. But besides that, you know, convenient twist, I guess, where he didn't and he comes to save the day. What did you feel emotionally about the development of this rot and the tragedy of the whole situation? Did you have sympathy for any of the characters or not? I was just curious.
Well, I mean, I felt it was cool that the girl's ghost was happy at the end.
Yep.
That was cool. And of course, they heavily allude to there being a sequel to this movie at the end, was there a TV movie? Or
there was a second. Yeah, they did make a second called Stir of Echoes: The Homecoming, which was which was a TV movie by Lionsgate, sci-fi, okay. Sci-Fi Channel, I guess. Rob Lowe starred in that one, actually.
Okay, the only connection to the previous work is his inclusion of Jay Witzke, who had a key role in the original film, but is only a secondary character here, and that's bullshit. Because really the whole setup was, hey, this kid can hear dead people everywhere!
What about you, Mike? You haven't given your opinion of it. The tragedy and
well, like I said, I think I said it's what I was saying before is it's there's tragedy in the brother, the sons were assholes. Now they're young, they're stupid. Young people do stupid things, but most young people don't do young stupid things that end up in sexual assault and second degree murder.
Right.
They went the wrong way with the father. With the fathers at the end trying to burn the house down and kill everybody. And, that was a little frustrating. I mean, one thing I always, with a lot of these ghost stories, I always have trouble with is that a lot of them, like The Changeling, do end up just turning into a detective story. And at that point, the ghost story always takes a back seat to that, and so there's nothing scary going on, right? It stops being a scary movie. Like, that's one of the things I loved about The Ring, because The Ring follows that formula, and, you know, oh, we're scared, oh, something's a ghost. Oh, wait, the ghost wants to be put to rest. And then the ghost comes out of the TV and tries to kill them.
that was an awesome movement in the ring when the kid's like, wait, no, what did you do?
Exactly. No, she was evil. Yeah. And or like Poltergeist, the ghosts were the bad guys. Yeah. I mean, you had the business developer, but the ghosts were there. They were the bad things. The killer tree and the killer clown doll and that's, you know, it's not. It is a cliche, and it's to me, it's just not one of my favorite cliches. I think it's well handled here, and it's an interesting story, but it does kind of stop being scary after you get to a certain point. You know, it's like, I'm thinking, like, do you have the scene when mom goes down the basement and, you know, like the ghost touches the light and makes it go out and she's basically stalking mom. That was effectively creepy and, you know, using reveals and so forth. But, you know, at a certain point, it turns into Close Encounters of the Third Kind with Richard Dreyfuss building the mountain in the backyard. You know, it's
right. It was the director also made reference to that in his commentary.
And Mike, I do like how you brought up, you know, the first, 40 minutes or 50 minutes of kind of scary, creepy, effective, you know, horror film, I guess. And then the second half isn't really that scary. And you know what? That's another reason why this reminded me of The Changeling. Because The Changeling is the same way. You know, you have the ball
right
down the stairs, and then you have the secret room and the wheelchair and all that, and then the last 40 minutes of that movie is the same thing, where it's now just a mystery of George C. Scott trying to find out where the body of the ghost is and who killed the ghost, you know.
And you know, it makes some sense, because my understanding is that Poe is kind of credited with inventing the detective story. And so, you know, there is a kinship between the horror story and the detective story, the murder mystery. And this is a way to get the two together, but it's not my, I want to watch a ghost story. I don't want to watch a detective story. I, you know, but even though I know that's kind of inevitably ends up where they are, because really, what can you do with a ghost?
Well, and ghost stories are, the ghost stories, the good ones often have that formula.
Yeah. So, you know, that is what it is. That's for me why ghost stories are not, you know, up there with monster movies. You know, it's, monster movies very rarely turn out to be detective stories.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. And that's the thing about a lot of ghost stories is that, turn into these detective stories like The Changeling did and the film Ghost Story did and this one and Sixth Sense and so on and on and on and on versus a true horror story, ghost story. And, oddly, I can't think of any off the top of my head at the very moment that really worked for me. Though, you know, if I sat down for an hour or so, I could think of any. But do any of you have any ghost story films that were just straight horror with that don't turn to detective that you can think of? I mean, it's kind of tough, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can name many, many stories. You know,
Ghostbusters.
Well, you know what it is. You know, Mike, I was gonna say no. I'm talking about scary ones.
No.
I was gonna say, like The Curse of the Demon, but again, that was a demon.
That's a demon. Yeah.
Well, I almost said Paranormal Activity, but that's also a demon. So.
Yeah. There you go. And then Poltergeist, right? I mean, what would that one be called? And was that effectively scary? You know, I mean,
well, I think it was. It's and yeah, there is a human element to it, but it's still, you know, got a gaggle of evil of ghosts willing to kill people, right? I mean, you have that sort of, oh, we solved the problem, we rescue the girl, and everything's happy, and then shit hits the fan.
Surprise!
Right.
Right. So I think, and see, that's for me why Poltergeist stands up well. Yeah, but also it depends on just how do they reveal it, and it becomes a little pedestrian at the end. I think this was the murder mystery was a good thing, but like there are things that they do. Oh man, I feel like I'm kicking the crap out of this film, and it doesn't deserve it.
Right, but that's what you do.
Yeah, but it doesn't deserve, especially after I didn't really kick the crap out of Love and the Time of Monsters, but it's you know, like you have the cop who's there. I want to talk to your husband because I seriously need to give you some exposition. And after that point, I will completely disappear from the film because I've seen The Shining.
Yeah.
And I saw what happened to Scatman Brothers. And fuck that shit. No, I'm just going to tell you what I need to. And I'm going to sit here
and I'll stay here and fuck you.
And then, you know, I haven't seen the film in 10 years. I didn't remember the ending at all. I remembered next to nothing about this film. Other than the party where he's hypnotized. and he sees ghosts or something. I couldn't even remember exactly what it was that happened to him. But when you get to the point where he discovers the body and he reaches out and touches her and they show you the whole thing,
uh-huh.
I'm kind of like, dude, you gave me all the puzzle pieces and I put them together. I don't need to be walked through it.
Well, and here's the thing you got to remember, Mike, is that most people are stupid.
That is true.
Including most of them that go to movies.
That is true. But this is the catch, is that do I want movies made for them or do I want movies made for me? And
Hollywood doesn't make movies for you. Go watch independent film.
I'm sorry. I enjoyed like my blockbuster films. Like, you know, I don't need everything. I sometimes wonder, in this case, I think they may have actually been more underestimating the audience than they needed to. I didn't need 5 minutes in the film devoted to showing me the assault and the
toothpaste. Didn't know it.
No, I didn't need it.
Yeah, you're better off for it. Trust me.
So between exposition guy and this, it does sometimes feel like you could have taken maybe 10 minutes out of the film, tightened it up. I think they could have maybe gone for a less mustache twirly, what was the name of that character? Snidely Whiplash or something like that? Simon vs. Sinister or something? You know, I didn't need that turn from the people. Just simply having them admit what they did and getting arrested, not to pull a page out of Phil's book. But that would make them human as opposed to a caricature, which is, I think, where they went with it.
Whatever. I thought it was fun.
And the guy coming out of the basement's like,
I had a problem with.
I only pretended to kill myself.
I was on your side all along.
I was on your side to save you from the lunatics. That didn't make any. Oh, well.
You want to chime in here?
it's fair. I mean, it's two different opinions, and it is what it is. I mean, I really don't think I can even add any more to it. What about you, Abe?
Not a whole lot either. I mean, I got nothing else to add. I think we got that one pretty much cleared up.
All right, fair enough. Any further items that we wanted to bring up about the film, the plot, or its comparison to other horror films or whatever?
I think we tapped this. I don't want to completely. I'm recommending the movie. I'm recommending with maybe expectations in check because I don't know if it's aged as well. And it's the big thing at the time was comparing this to Sixth Sense. I have not seen Sixth Sense in well over a decade, so I can't even say whether that's aged as well. But it's a decent ghost story, and if you are a ghost story fan, it's one of the better ones I think you could find. And, you know, just kind of kicking the tires of it. We've spent 2 hours talking about this movie, which is probably more than most people would ever think about it. Right? And 2 hours of kicking the tires out of the film, we start going, oh, wait a minute. We found a problem with the tire. I think most people would be perfectly fine with most of what happened in the movie.
It's a perfectly well done 15-year-old ghost movie.
Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed it.
A strong performance from Kevin Bacon.
Bacon's always good. Maybe not a huge dosage, but
I gotta say it's funny. I think the little kid, because he's at that right age where
kid's a little creep. He's creeped me out.
I was going to say, he's at just that right age where it's almost impossible to find a kid that age who can actually deliver a line. But I think because they're almost always a little younger than that, so they're just a prop, or they're a little bit older than that, so they can act. And I think they actually did a good job with the kid. And amazingly, Haley Joel Osment grows up to be in Tusk, and this kid, nothing happens to, right? It's
right.
I don't know who had it better, but this is like the only thing he ever did.
Yeah, the only movie I can recall seeing where, especially genre, where the child actors were really, really strong was Frailty.
Yeah.
But they were also a lot older than this kid was.
That's true.
And to be honest, the kid in the Babadook, he was pretty good, right?
Yeah, I thought he was pretty good.
Oh, that's true. That kid was good. That kid was good. Yeah.
Yeah, so he was pretty good.
But really, Phil, what has he done since?
What has he done in the last 6 months?
A dick.
He's already a has-been.
That's right.
I saw him out on the street corner begging for milk.
I would say that it's definitely worth a watch. I mean, obviously, I guess like you said, Mike, it's a bit dated in a sense. But you know, any film. I mean, you've watched Twilight Zone or some of the Outer Limits from the '60s. You know, you watch them and you go, "Well, it's a little dated," and yet they could still be pretty good films. You know, so
well they are dated. I think it's just the idea that for people our age, not accounting somebody else on this podcast. the idea that you could look at a movie from 1999 and go, it's looking a little dated. And you go, wait a minute, that was from fucking 1999.
Right.
I'm old. I don't want to be old.
we're getting there. First God time it hit us. Me is when I heard Van Halen on a classic rock station. I was like, wait, that's not classic rock. That's current. Oh, wait. Damn it.
Well, I think I've told this story before, but it's for me it was when it was 1996 and I was substitute teaching. And it was the first year I was substitute teaching. And this 14-year-old girl, maybe 15-year-old girl, comes up to me and asks, have you ever heard of a movie called Star Wars? And I wanted to punt her into orbit. That's like going to my parents and said, did you ever hear of this concert called Woodstock? You know, you're talking about the defining moment of my generation, for better or worse.
So anyway. That's Stir of Echoes. It's definitely worth a check. You can rent it $3.99. You can buy the discs new, or you know, cheap. You can buy, you know, used disc on Amazon for like a penny plus shipping of $2.99. But easily available. It appears that the disc, which I don't have, is a good package based off of what you said, Eric. Right?
Yeah. Well, oddly enough, I still have the DVD from back in the day. I do not have this on Blu-ray. I'm assuming that if you were to pick up a Blu-ray of it, it would have the same commentary on there, which I can recommend highly.
Yep. Very good. And any further thoughts, Mike or Abe?
No, go watch it. But as we've all stated, you know, kind of lower expectations because it is a bit dated. And if you had seen plenty of films with a similar storyline, it's going to feel familiar with a lot of certain tropes that pop up.
And it, because of the time it came out, I think it got a bum rap
because it was competing with Sixth Sense and people thought it was ripping it off, even though it only came out a month later. It was probably in production at the same time.
Or made really, really freaking fast. But, but also I go the other way, is that because of the backlash to that, there are a lot of people, I think, maybe remembering it more fondly than it may deserve.
And to be honest, quote-unquote rip-off and all that other stuff, which Eric's absolutely right. It was in the production at the exact same time. It just happened to be released a month later. The point is the book was written in 1958, so this concept has been around for 44 years by the time the movie actually was released. So, you know, you can say The Changeling kind of ripped it off. You could say The Sixth Sense kind of ripped it off, on and on. You know, obviously they all have their different twists and things and whatever. Right. But, yeah. So.
No, it's not that it's a rip-off, but it's when two things come out at the same time covering the same ground. You know, this is like Rob Roy and Braveheart.
Yep.
You know, you're kind of guys with swords and kilts in Scotland. You know, it's killing English people.
Yep.
Came out the same year, but you know, they were held, and one wins, one loses.
Yep.
You know, and it's, you know, so, someone out there, you know, you had Deep Star 6 and The Abyss. And I'm sure if you look out there, someone in the world preferred Deep Star 6. I don't know who it would be, and I would never want to meet them, but I'm sure they're out there.
All right, so that I guess we can wrap it up. Once again, 1990 film, A Stir of Echoes.
1999, Phil.
That's right, 1999, A Stir of Echoes, directed and written by David Cope. But originally based off of the 1958 novel by Richard Matheson, and stars Kevin Bacon in one of his better performances. Though, to be honest, Kevin Bacon really doesn't ever phone in a performance that I've ever seen, no matter how small or large the role is. All right, so I guess with that stated, I guess we can wrap it up. So, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about Stir of Echoes tonight. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.
I could not foresee this thing happening to you.